road. Cricket!
Your health and well-being show here on Channel Radio.
Who cares when? Every Monday at noon on Channel Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome to Who Cares Wins on channelradio.co.uk. My name is Jan Mulligan, and with me in the studio today we have a special guest who I will introduce you to in just a moment. But first off, I just want to send good wishes to Angela and her family. As you know, Angela came back to us last week with her guest Shirley Palmer, but is taking a couple of weeks break to rest and recoup. So best wishes to you, Angela, and we look forward to seeing you again on December the 14th. Angela and Shirley announced a competition in last week's show, and just to let you know, that competition is still ongoing. We will announce the winner on Angela's return, so you've got another couple of weeks grace to get your competition entry in. I'll explain all, if you haven't heard it, I'll explain all towards the end of the show, so never fear, your chance is still there to win a signed copy of Shirley's book. It's a bit blowy today here on the marsh. It's a bit windy. If you've had winds and gales wherever you are, I hope you're safe and structures are safe. But hunker down with your cup of tea because we've got a fascinating journey to go on today. My guest in the studio is Miles Allen. Hello, Miles.
Good morning.
Now, you are a man of many talents. You are an author. You are a public speaker. You are a coach, a writing coach. You also edit, you also publish, man of many, many talents. But you've had quite a journey to get where you are today, and that's really the focus of what we're going to be talking about, isn't it?
Yes.
So let me take you back, as far back as you'd like to go, and let's set the scene for the listener about who is Miles, where did you come from?
Well, technically I was born in Essex. As a baby, though, I was brought over to the Medway towns, and I was born and bred in Medway. Got out just in time, perhaps. So I was born and bred in the Medway towns. I was talking about it earlier about these four decisions that kind of did change my life. And the first one was at the age of six, and it was just the most profound thing that could have happened to me. But at the time, it was the most silly of decisions. And I was a climber as a six-year-old, so I used to like climbing trees. So in the back garden, I was climbing the tree. And I was quite a long way up, and I was just walking out across a branch, and I just thought to myself, there was this grey dead twig sticking up, and I thought, I wonder if that would take my weight. And that was the decision that changed my life, because I thought to myself, yes, it will, and it didn't. And it broke. I fell, and I broke my right arm. Now, you might say, well, that's nothing special. Kids do that sort of thing all the time. But for me, I was born left-handed, and back in those days, it was a right-handed world. Mm-hmm. So you were made to use your right hand, and breaking my right arm made me use my left hand for 6 weeks. And when the plaster came off, I was forced to use my right hand again. And my mother noticed not long after that I was trying to read, and I had one finger under each word, forming it carefully. And she said, why aren't you reading normally? And we went to a child psychiatrist in the end, and they said, you've had cross-lateral confusion, which is where the brain flips from one side to the other, and it gets rather messed up inside. You know, if you're born left-handed, you're generally sort of right-handed, creative, and so on. And he said he's going to have learning difficulties from that point on, and probably emotional difficulties as well. And that's not going to stop until he comes out of his teenage years and his adult brain really kicks in. And that kind of happened for a while. And then the second decision, which was nothing to do with me again, which is my parents decided to change, or my father changed jobs. And they moved, and we moved into a semi-detached house, and in the other half was a family with a young man my age. Well, young man, not six or seven back then, but and he turned out to be a genius. He was a professor of medical electronics by the age of 28. Wow. He was straight-A students in everything he took. And I used to love science. It was the only thing that really made me interested. So I basically, on the back of his shirt tails and some of the incredible things that he would do at a very young age, it was programming computers in ones and noughts at the age of 12. Back then, which was exceptional, not something I could do. But anyway, I was basically, you know, on the back of that, I went for a job, came out with two O-levels, science, couple of weak science O-levels, And started work at Marconi, or went for an interview anyway.
Oh, right, the electronics company.
That's right, up at Rochester Airfield. And just as an electronics technician, and because I love doing it, mm-hmm. and they looked at my resume, and that wasn't all that good. There were 500 kids trying to get into this 100 slots. And he went through the whole thing. It wasn't going very well. And he said, well, have you got any hobbies? And I said, yes. I said, I love astronomy and I do electronics. And he went, oh, tell me about that. And so by the time I'd gone through what I could do and transforming equations to do with frequency, and he said, okay, that's years ahead of anyone. Anyone was going to do. And I got the job. So, and the moment I started, everything changed. And maybe that was this thing that the psychiatrist was talking about, because that was around about the time of the adult years, because I thought, these guys are paying me money and they're not getting anything for a whole year. I basically, you know, wire things up and break them down again after they've been marked and give it to the next person. So I thought, this is amazing. I'm going to work very hard. Mm-hmm. And I did. I was so proud, and I worked very, very, you know, as hard as I could. And I did that for 25 years. I ended up writing software for fighter aircraft, designing systems, and getting into project management, leading teams. I'd come up with all kinds of new ways of doing things. My creative side was starting to come out at last. And did very well until a rather unpleasant time when I met three difficult characters, managers who weren't great at their job. I was sent in to try and sort some problems out under a new director. Which we did, and we sorted the problems out. But these three guys weren't very happy about this, and they decided to undermine everything that was going on. And my director that was brought in one day, I came in, his name wasn't on the door. And I looked up and thought, I know what's going on here. And then they systematically ended up destroying my career, confidence, and eventually I ended up having panic attacks and passed out in a international group that was together that I was doing a short presentation for, and when I woke up I was a different person. So I had the managing director waving his coat over me, and I thought, that's the end of my career. And I survived a few more years, and I have plenty of contacts in the business, so I got other jobs, but I was just a different person. I just lost my nerve, and it was a nervous breakdown, I guess, but you tried to cover it in those days as best you could, and yes, you just carried on. But
because there's still stigma attached to that sort of thing, but back then, what sort of time period are we talking?
That's about the year 2000, about 15 years ago.
Okay.
So it wasn't, if you were trying to be a manager,
yeah,
you know, which is where I was going, and you had these problems, basically that was it. You were finished, so you tried to hide it. And, of course, it's the worst thing to do. And now we know companies look for people and take them out of this situation and deal with it before it gets too bad and help them recover. And I didn't have any of that, no support mechanism. And unfortunately, my directors who were looking after me, there was the engineering director, was very, very good terms with, he retired. Mm-hmm. And so one by one, it was bad luck as well, but one by one, I just lost all of the opportunities until in the end I said, I just want to go. And they said no the first time when redundancy came up, but the second time I kind of was more insistent. Mm-hmm. Said, look, I can't cope with this. There was obviously the signs were there that I was not, you know, performing the way I should do. And they said, okay. So I got out. So I took some money, and that took me into, you know, a time of my own. I lost everything. I lost my partner, my four-bedroom detached executive home and holidays and all those things. Ended up very much on my own, apart from friends and family, and thank goodness they're there when you need them.
Absolutely.
Otherwise I wouldn't have got through it, I don't think. And I spent quite a few years pretty much spending all my money that I'd got from redundancy and other savings, just trying to get by and avoid being put in a bad situation, you know, a difficult situation where I'd have to face people. But I tried running a business and it went okay. I turned over quite a lot of money in the first year, but the next year was a lot less. And the year after that, it was tiny. And I thought, I've just lost, you know, I can't do this anymore. Mm. That was on the software side. So, yeah, so that's where it kind of started to go. And there was no way out of it that I could see. And I was in deep depression and really trying to cope with it all. And strange things happen.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you've come an awful long way since then. There's some great successes since then. Had that situation not occurred at the time, would you still be corporate man, do you think?
If it had gone well, yes, I think so. And I was telling myself for a lot of years, I'm leaving in 6 months, because I just had such
a lot of us do that.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I had ambitions to do other things, but I did enjoy my job. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, it was comfortably well paid, so there wasn't any real reason to go, other than the fact that I just had these big ideas. I'm very idealistic, you know, very creative. So I had these ideas about doing other things. And, you know, as the higher up I got, so the more difficult and more resistance there was to getting what you needed done you know, completed because other people had other ideas.
Yeah.
And so, and I wasn't that good at pushing that. And I think that was the whole emotional thing, back to the childhood and, you know, what the psychiatrist was saying, that was a difficult thing to do. So, yeah, so that was the kind of third decision that was made. I probably just skipped over about going in and sorting these guys out. Right. It was nothing to do with me, you know, just, okay, I'll go and help out. I had no idea that I was stepping on a landmine, you know.
Absolutely.
And
and apart from the difficulties you had over the, you know, the left-right-handedness and the learning difficulty side of things in the early days, had you any dreams as a child as to what you wanted to be in the future?
I would have loved to have been an astronaut.
Right.
Certainly astronomer. I knew I'd never going to be able to do that. I'd love to have worked in one of those big... big telescopes. I think that was my childhood dream. I mean, even as the age of 10, I knew all the stars I could name in the not just the constellations, but the stars. And I knew, I read books cover to cover to do with astronomy over and over again. It was just a big thing that I absolutely loved to do. So I think if I'd have had my ideal job, certainly being a scientist in that area would have been it. And maybe if I hadn't made that one decision and fell out of a tree and,
yes,
you know, maybe it would have ended up in that direction. I don't know.
Right.
But that's where my heart lies. I'm big into cosmology and Higgs boson and all those kind of things, you know, I follow it, you know, very much so.
Well, we're going to take a short break now for a piece of music, and all the music today has been chosen by Miles, and the first track we have is Supertramp, Goodbye Stranger. Now, this has got a story for it.
I mean, although we talk about all these depressive moments, in my teenage years I had the most fantastic time, and there's just some of the songs today are going to be back to that era. I used to play a lot of tennis, almost thought about going professional at one point, and just loved it. The summer of 76 and 77, all those years were just so hot, not like now.
Mm-hmm.
Having a fantastic time. So these songs just take me back over that time.
Excellent. So sit back and enjoy. This is Goodbye Stranger by Supertramp.
It was an early morning yesterday. I was up before the dawn. And I really have enjoyed my stay. But I must be moving on. Like a king without a castle, like a queen without a throne. I'm an early morning lover, and I must be moving on. Now I believe in what you say is the undisputed truth. But I have to have things my own way to keep you in my youth. Without an anchor, like a slave without a chain, just a thought of those middle ladies as I shimmer through my fingers. Now I'm going shining, shining like brand new. I know I look behind me, my troubles will be few. Behind me, my
Your health and well-being show here on Channel Radio.
Who Cares Wins? Every Monday at noon on Channel Radio.
I'm a rock star.
So welcome back to Who Cares Wins and me, Jan Mulligan. And for all of us of a certain age, that took me right back, as you said, to the mid-70s, that very hot summer of 76.
Good times.
Very good times. We're just going to take a moment and remember that. But you're listening to Who Cares Wins on Channel Radio, sponsored by Kent Connections, the holistic therapy magazine, available in all good retailers, but free of charge. So grab your copy. We're in there with lots of other good therapies and practitioners. I'm chatting today with Miles Allen, author, man of many talents. But we're going through your backstory, as we say, Miles, and we've gone through how you went to a traditional working life, as we all do, but then through no fault of your own, colleagues around you setting up you to fall, effectively, which led to you stepping back and saying, no, it's time to stop that.
Yeah.
I need time for myself. But it led to quite a dark time. As you said, you lost everything.
Yeah, I mean, I came from, I'd say, a very successful career, and everything was sorted for the rest of my life, and I was going to have a good pension and, holidays, skiing. And it was the kind of, not quite jet set, but it was a very comfortable kind of, yuppie kind of life, I guess you'd say. And yes, then everything went, once the depression sets in after I left the company, and what I'd been left with is a legacy from that. I found it very difficult to cope, and panic attacks would set in for the simplest of reasons, which was so alien to me, as I was probably overconfident throughout my years. And that's what obviously helped me to accelerate my career so well from where I came from. When it collapsed, there was no support mechanism for me,
right?
Other than friends and family, like I said, which was a godsend. But I was living on my own then. And depression does strange things to your head when you're on your own, because it's being very creative, I suppose, as well, very delusional.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it makes things up in your head about what reality is and who you are and where you're going, and it tries to find ways of soothing the real reality, the hard reality of what's happened, and get you out of things. I remember one of the strangest things, which I've never mentioned before, it's probably quite trivial to people, but for me, one of the strangest things was I used to go into town in the evenings in the summer, and I'd be looking for a bar, for instance, and I think I'll find myself a bar with there'll be a pianist in there playing a piano, and I'll go and find my, like, pretty much American kind of thing, you know. I'll go and sit at the bar every evening, and they'll get to know me. I'm Miles, you know, and when they come in, and I'll become, you know, kind of like that, nice and quiet, and maybe I'll play a piano or something now and again, that sort of thing. And you get all these kind of strange things that go through that making your head survive, and then a few days later or weeks later, you come out of that, and you'd be thinking something else. And I remember going downtown every time, walking out the back door, going down the back garden, not going out the front door. I still don't know why that is. I can't work this out. Going out through the garage, unlocking the garage, going out through the back of the garage, shutting the garage door, locking it up, and then going into town and coming back the same way. Your head
is something your head does, isn't
it? It's strange.
Yeah.
So, I mean, looking back, it's a very uncomfortable time to try and remember, because you're out of control. You just, luckily, because I had money behind me from redundancy, I didn't need to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of got worse and worse. I started, because I used to be a software engineer, you got into computer games, and there was a game back then called Acheron's Call, and that was a kind of pre-runner to the big online games now, like World of Warcraft, where you could play with other people. And I would play this for absolutely hours every single day, because it kept me away from reality and let me absorb in this thing into another world. So it's all awkward to talk about, and difficult to speak about, but I know other people have been through this, so I do understand. And what brings you out of it in the end, usually some kind of trigger. And it got really bad for me for about 1 week. And I remember thinking back. I remember seeing a polar bear in London Zoo, and there was like a 20-foot stretch in its area. And it would wander backwards and forwards, turn, wander, turn. And it did this all day. And they said basically it had been sent mad because of its conditions, and it couldn't do what it needed to do. And this 1 week, looking back now, I remember doing that. I had 1 week of walking backwards and forwards in my house over a 10-foot strip, mm-hmm. just pacing backwards and forwards and trying to make sense of the world. And clearly, looking back now, I think it was my left brain and my right brain, the logical side of reality and the fantasy side, if you like, trying to fight it out and come back. That's the way it seems to me anyway. And it was on a Thursday, and it was about 11 o'clock, and all of a sudden it came to a head. And it's very difficult to talk about, but
sure.
I remember suddenly reality came back, and it's very difficult to talk about. I dropped to my knees, basically. I know it sounds dramatic, but I suddenly dropped to my knees, and I just wept like a child. Mm-hmm. And And I suddenly saw everything for the way it was. And that was all good news, because I then saw why people were doing things, and I saw me for who I was. And I was very happy with that, and because I realised people were doing things because of their own reasons. And I had a girlfriend at the time, and she was trying to make me feel bad through it by pretending she was seeing somebody else. And I suddenly realised what was really happening was she loved me very much. And so everything in my life suddenly unraveled, and I saw it for what it really was. And that was it. That was as far as my brain wanted to go, I guess. And it said, you've had enough now. Either you break mm-hmm. or you turn. So I think I could have easily gone the other side. It was like having a brainstorm, I guess. I felt there was a storm in my head.
It's that turning moment, isn't it?
Well, it was horrible. I was completely out of control in my head, and reality had gone. And then suddenly it all snapped back. And from that point on, I started to climb back out of it, and the depression started to go. I mean, I still have it, because you don't ever lose it when it's that serious, but you deal with it every day. But I call it my revelation day. It was my moment of clarity. And then I started moving in a different direction and started to come back out of it, and then the fourth decision obviously comes along.
And just to say that, it's that clarity moment that it's interesting that you know the day and the time that it happened. And we've had previous guests on that said that moment in their lives that either a decision or an event has changed things for them. Yeah. And so many people can name the day and the time. And as you said, it was pivotal. You could have gone either way.
It is.
But you came out on the positive side, but still living with the consequences.
Yes. Yeah, well, I mean, you still have to, it's not an instant fix, because the brain is so muddled with everything that's been going on. And the emotional stress and emotional content that's in your head is so vast, it overwhelms everything else. So you just don't quickly lose all of that, but you suddenly see things for the way they are, and then you stop being delusional. I think that's what happened.
Right.
Everything was clear to me about what needed, who I was. Mm-hmm. Well, this was a moment, you know, people say you've got to find yourself, if you like. And it was that moment that I stopped having any wrong thoughts about who I was. And I was happy with who I was.
Right.
And I realized that I wasn't a perfect person, mm-hmm. and that's okay. You know,
yes.
I think one of the things that used to help me was the transactional analysis, which is the child, adult and parent inside you. And the book that was written, very famous one, was called I'm Okay, You're Okay. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, I understand that book completely now. I never understood the title before, and now I get it. So it was perfectly okay to be me, and that was what really brings you out of it, and you stop stressing over it and think, yeah, I'm flawed, and that's fine, and everybody is, and that's okay. Okay to be like that. And when you have that, you feel you can't be tripped up and exposed anymore mm-hmm. because you've accepted it yourself. So, and that's when I started talking about it and telling people what's going on, and ending up with, you know, shows like this and talking to people and getting out. They couldn't have done this before. It's too you feel so silly about it, you know, and you feel weak and vulnerable, and you know.
But it's about, as you say, it's about making that change and building bricks from there to secure things and starting to see happy again.
Yes,
as you mentioned. I think it's time for another piece of music, and this is a happy piece that you and your partner at the moment independently found.
Yes,
it both was, find to be
very uplifting.
The thing
is, we'd never ever text each other before about a song, because we just don't do that, I guess. But I text the kids actually saying, hey, there's this fantastic song, have you heard it? And I've never done that before. And strangely enough, my partner texts me saying, I've just heard this fantastic song on the radio. And so it was just one of those songs, and it's very happy and I love it. So that's why it's on.
Okay, well, I'd never heard this one before. And this has got a fantastic track. It's called Peanut Butter Jelly, which I must say, I'm a bit of a fan on peanut butter jelly on toast, by a group called Glantis. Here we go. Both bopping along to that one. It's a bit chilly in the studio today, so I'm very pleased with your music choice there of Peanut Butter Jelly. It's nice to bop along to warm us up a bit.
It is.
My name's Jan Mulligan. I'm in the studio today with my guest, Miles Allen. So, Miles, we had a particularly low time in that last segment of when the depression had kicked in, but you had that clarifying moment and turned the corner coming out, and we've reached the fourth of your four decisions.
Yes, the fourth one, again, this was utterly trivial. Part of this gaming thing I used to do, they set up a forum, because we were worldwide doing this. Somebody set up a proper group gaming forum that we were, could post on and talk to each other. It's all very common nowadays with Facebook, but back then it was practically unheard of. And we had a very clever programmer in the group, and he designed this system for us, and we were using it. And on one of particular occasion, after we've been playing this game for a while, one of the guys decided he's put a post up saying and wrote a little short story and saying, could somebody continue it about our characters, and can you continue it? And I thought, I'd like to do that. So I did. I wrote a short piece, and then somebody else wrote a short piece, and we continued the story, and I wrote another piece, and we ended up finishing this off, and I loved it. I really enjoyed doing it. And that kind of disappeared off to one side for a while, and then I started to try and do a business and to get some money coming in and so on. And then it was probably a couple of years later, I stumbled across this writing on my computer while I was looking for some work for a client. And it was 10 o'clock at night, and I didn't have any time because I had to get this work ready for the morning. And I come across this folder, and I opened it and saw this writing, and I carried on, basically. And it wasn't until 3 o'clock in the morning that I looked up and went, oh, and I haven't finished my work for the client. So that was the decision, really, is just to open that folder, because I shouldn't have done that. I wonder what that is. And if I hadn't have done that, I wouldn't be an author now. So it was that tiny little thing. So I managed to do the stuff for the client the next day and got through that. And I thought, well, I enjoyed it. I came back the next night and carried on writing. And that was till 2 o'clock in the morning. And this went on and on and on. And I decided I'm going to write a book. I didn't intend to get it published or anything. I just thought I'd just write a book for myself because I'm really enjoying it. I love fantasy, so I thought I'd write a fantasy book. By the time I was halfway through, I saw the whole thing and it pulled me all the way through. And by the time I got to the end, I saw a 6-book series. So my creative side again, exploding outwards, big picture. And I thought, that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to do this. And I sent it off to an editor. He was part of the New York Times book reviews, it turns out, by just a guy on
Did
the internet.
Did you know at the time?
No. I only found out just recently, but he came back and said, look, you've got great ideas here. You can write, but the trouble is you can't write fiction. You don't understand about getting all the, making compelling and building good characters. Mm-hmm. It was okay.
Right.
He just needed, and cutting down from 155,000 words to 110, and I'm thinking, well, there'll be nothing left. But anyway, I decided, I gave up everything. I thought, that's it. I'm going to become an author and go for it. So I had all my savings left. I sold my business and thought, I've got 2 years. And after 18 months, I sent the book back. It was down to 112,000 words as it happened. Sent it back to the editor and he came back and said, you've done it. I says, it's amazing in such a short period of time. I'm very impressed. You've done everything I said you should do. You should go ahead with it. So I did. And I tried to get some publishers, but to be honest, it's extremely difficult to do that. My heart really wasn't in it because I'm a like to do things myself.
Mm-hmm.
And self-publishing came up, and because I'm computer literate, I thought, I'm going to do that and give it a go. So I did, and my first book came out, and opened up the packet, and there was this box of books gleaming about. I've got a fantastic guy doing the cover for me, who did it for free because he loved the book, and he's a very, very good, high-class guy who works on the big Disney films and things. And that made a big difference. So I shoved him in a bag and went down the high street. And this is how your confidence changes, because I couldn't face people, panic attacks, all that kind of, just talking to people. And because of the book and what it had done for me, I put him in a bag and I just walked down the high street. And I thought, I had 10 books in a bag. And I went to the bank to pay a check-in, and the first book was sold to the girl behind the bulletproof glass.
I'm not allowed to do that.
Just by saying I'm an author, and I was grinning like, you know, a fool. So I was just bursting with confidence, and I felt so high. And then after doing that, of course, at the bank, I just was walking on clouds. So I sold all 9 books going back on the way home. And that was the start, really. And then I started going into Waterstones and saying, hey, I'm an author, you know, and convincing them I should go in there and do book signings. And I was obviously bursting because they said yes. And then kind of the break point was, there was a, you know, the first person in the place to go and talk to, you know, a customer. And I just looked at them and thought, well, I can either stay here and wait for them to come to me, or I'm going to walk up to them and go, hi. And before I know where I was halfway across, and I just said, hi, I'm Miles Allen. I'm a new author. No one knows me yet. So off I went. Great, I sold a book.
Fantastic.
And that went on, and I sold, I think the most I sold in the day was 50 books in Waterstones, which was like enough to, you know, put you on top of the charts, as it were. So that went very well. But I sold hundreds of books in Waterstones, and the message flew around that I was what I could do, and they all passed it on. And I did 10 Waterstone stores or something. One in Ashford, I went back 2 more times because they loved it so much. And so that was kind of the launch of it. And then I did the Kindle, and thousands went out on the Kindle and things. So it was great. So
I've got so many questions popping here.
Yeah,
let's go back to basics.
Mm-hmm.
The name of the book.
All right, the name of the book is The Walkers of Legend.
Right.
Okay, it's a series now, so it's also in the Walkers of Legend series. Book 2 has just been published as of, 2 months ago now?
Okay.
So that's called Legend's Awakening. And I've had lots of people asking me for that one, so I'm really chuffed. I've had lots of fans, so that one's now come out, so you know that's going forward. And I'm writing book 3, so that'll be coming out in 18 months' time.
and a synopsis of that first book.
Right, the synopsis is I decided to choose a completely different world. Because I'm into big things, I decided it was going to be an epic. So think of Lord of the Rings.
Okay.
Think how it all started off, quite simple, with fairy-footed hobbits and, you know, magic fireworks and things like that, and how it all ends up in this grand scale, saving the world, terrible evil, and these hobbits are basically, you know, involved in this and have no real capacity to do anything about it, but they get involved in it. I've kind of wanted to do something on that scale, but not Lord of the Rings.
Right.
So I don't have pixies and hobbits and elves and that sort of thing. They're just people.
Right.
But it's in a different world, very similar to the Lord of the Rings time, so it's swords and shields. Mm-hmm. And we have an empire which discovered how to, quite a small empire, but discovered how to live forever, or not live forever, but live for a long time. And they had to extract something from people's blood under torture. It was the only way to get it.
Right.
So they started torturing people. And eventually they ran out of kind of people to torture. So they built an army, invaded another land, and they kept doing this. And now, where we are now, the start of the books of legend, is they've conquered 9/10, and there's one last piece left. The good guys left, if you like.
Right.
And so I have two people that get involved in this. One's a young mage who gets kidnapped in by them, because this empire has a very powerful secret to do with magic, which is part of the driving issues of the book. And he gets kidnapped so they don't kill him, because they don't like to take him out before they go in. And then his friend goes after him. So it's really basically the story of one guy waking up in the empire and how strange it is.
Mm-hmm.
And then his friend, who's just a woodsman, going, hey, they're basically early 20s, these guys. Hey, this is not fair. I'm going after him. But the odds are ridiculous. He doesn't even know if he can get across the mountains,
right,
which are a big mountain divide. So he can't fight or anything like this. And he's got to try and get away into this impossible, you know, place. But no one has ever returned from the empire. So, that's kind of where it's all set off. And it's his journey, meeting people and how the groups come together and how he heads off into the empire. And
you say you've got six books in your mind.
Yep.
Are these the same two guys, without giving too much away, do they travel throughout?
Well, they're the main, we're called protagonists,
right,
in books.
Yeah.
So, yes, they'll go through. The bad guys kind of move around and change.
Okay.
I like to put one in each place. But it's in two trilogies, and the first trilogy is called Two Men Against an Empire, which is kind of a clue to it. So that's these two guys, and they start to challenge impossible odds and start to make a difference, and things start to happen, and the internal politics of the empire starts to work against itself as it's starting to collapse. So there's all this you start to learn as you go through.
Right.
But the emperor is basically the main bad guy that we're heading towards. So not much happens in the first book to do with him, and we're heading in that direction.
Yeah.
And you have bad guys along the way, you know, your evil mages and things like that you have to defeat.
Okay.
So, and then the second trilogy is a whole new bag of fish, which leads on from the second one and ups the whole scale to, you know, more like Lord of the Rings.
And so what was the time frame between writing the first book and writing the second?
The second one, I think the first one took me a few years because it was part-time. The second one took me 3 years. Mm-hmm. It should have taken me 18 months. But because I'm a newish author, I thought, I know, I'm going to use this method to write this book because they say it's a good thing to do, and it didn't work for me because I'm an organic writer. I like to just spontaneously do things and see where it goes rather than plot it all out. So I basically had to rewrite it, and that's why it's only just come out now. So my fans were very upset with me because they said, you said it would be out November year before last, you know. I was like, I'm trying. So I made my excuses and all kinds of promises, and then eventually I got it out. So I mean, they're happy now, but so I'm really working on book three as quickly as possible, not to make the same mistake.
And so you self-published the first one, did you self-publish the second? Your plan to self-publish throughout?
I would like to continue to do that. I mean, the thing about publishing, not wishing to trash them too much, but they do tend to go for kind of the Jeremy Clarks. That's where all their budget goes. So even if you do get selected by them, and even if you're lucky enough, which is not usual nowadays, but lucky enough to get any kind of advance, still suffer from the fact that you're going to have to do all the marketing yourself to become popular. So you may as well just do it yourself.
Right.
As long as you can spend, it's about £3,000, you know, up front, including your first 150 books, you know, you get printed, which is quite a cost. And that's up to a professional standard book, as good as they can do.
Right.
So this is using external editors and proof checkers and, you know, and getting that whole quality up. I do most of it myself, but there's some things you need to do independently. And now I publish for other people as well. So, I mean, that helps to pay for the costs and things and keeps me, you know, keeps the mortgage paid.
And if you could talk to yourself back then when you were working on your first book, one top tip, what would you do differently? Would have made it go more smoothly?
Top tip. There's two top tips. One, learn everything you can. Mm-hmm. Don't just write the book first.
research.
Yeah, and two, get help. I mean, I do what I call NAGS now, which is New Author Group. So I run these around Kent, mm-hmm. and people come to me, and we basically run these every 2 weeks. So they sit in and they stay with it for a while. Some of them have been going for 3 years, just to learn how to learn the craft, and you know, so they don't make the mistakes that I did, basically. And that before they can kick off and write their book. So that would be the main tip that I do. For goodness sake, don't just sit down and write. Get help. Go to one of these next groups or a writing group and learn how to do it. And try and find one that's nice, because they are actually nice people, authors. I know they come across as kind of, you might think, oh, they'll be stuffy and they'll think I'm no good at English. And you have to get over that and say, look, they're all doing the same thing and they love people to come in and who are new, because they will like it once and they'll be very helpful. So all the groups that I run are very friendly groups.
It's like networking, but for authors.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Excellent. And you've said in our sort of pre-show discussions how writing has helped with the depression side of things.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was saying about the computer games and things that took you somewhere else. I mean, that's the thing that did for me. You know, in a book, your mind goes somewhere else, and it's in an environment that you control. So all the characters do what you want them to do. So there's no surprises, and you don't feel well, and you're actually on the outside looking in. So it's not as if you take any consequence for the actions of the characters that are in there. So that's one thing. It also gives you a tremendous feeling of accomplishment when you do one of these things, and you're always heading towards a goal every day. So rather than just drifting, you mm-hmm. know, I'm writing a book, and I know where I'm going. That's a good thing for a writer to think of the end of the book, okay? So you know where you're going. So there's that. It also gives you a great feeling of self-worth. And obviously when I had the books and I went down into town, and I was a different person. I was back to my old self for a while anyway, really over the moon. Just feeling, I'm an author. You know, it's a bit like being a brain surgeon. Or yeah. You have that kind of feeling, whether it's real or not, but you have that kind of thing. And people look at you and say, oh, really? And they're very interested, and they're kind of in awe of mm-hmm. you sometimes. And that kind of rubs off. And as long as you don't let that go to your head, you know, you realise who you really are, which is part of this Revelation Day and keeping me grounded. Then it does wonders for taking you out, you know, of who you are, and, you know, bringing you out of all the nasty thoughts that you have, and making you feel good about yourself.
Mm. Now, you mentioned your new authors groups that you run, but you also run workshops for new writers.
Yeah, I do like courses I'm setting up. I'll be kicking off next year. But one thing that I do is a half day thing. It's £35, and basically I get people to talk about books. Mm-hmm. So anyone who wants to come along, I take them from, hey, you don't know anything about what you're doing, where I was, and in basically half a day, I take you through and get rid of all the unknowns for you. Mm-hmm. What it's going to be like being a writer, give you all the top tips about writing, what you need to do, and give you some ideas about stories and what you need to do in order to better write them, and a bit about publishing as well.
Right.
And then how much money it's probably going to cost, what things you should expect, you know, when you're doing it, the good and the bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like all these positive things that I've said as well, and to try and encourage people, because I want more people to write, because what it did for me and how thoroughly nice it is to do it.
Absolutely.
I'd love people to get out there and realise that you can write, and, you know, with a little bit of help, you can start writing stories, and it's very rewarding. Once you know, it's a good talent to learn.
And does it matter what somebody wants to write, whether it's a fiction, factual, biography, cookbook, whatever?
There's a difference. You're either writing stories, which mm-hmm. is fiction or non-fiction, because you might be writing a biography or about your grandfather or something like this, or there's non-fiction, which is business, and that they are two distinct things. Now, I do involve every business writer that I do business with books as well. Everyone that I come across for business books, I always say to them, you need to write a story into it about yourself, mm-hmm. because people are much more interested in learning about you and what you've gone through and where you are now. Like your rite of passage, really, to be where you are, all the way up to your business and what you've been through, so they know that you're a credible person. Mm-hmm. As much that as actually talking about, you know, and this is my book now, and this is how I'm teaching you what I know, and that sort of thing. So,
okay. Yeah. So when is your next training course?
It's the end of January. I'm just finalising the dates.
Right.
If anybody's interested, I've actually set up a particular link. It's if you go to my website, which is www.milesallen, which is allen.net, and if you do / who cares wins, I've set up a link there, and it will take you through to the page, which will show you when the information is, and then you can send information to me, sign up to click a link in it, you can sign up, and I'll send you an email, when the time comes, and
we'll make sure we post that on all of our social media. Now, the next piece of music, I've never heard this one before either, so you're introducing me to music left, right and centre today. But this is something that inspires you when you're writing, yes?
Yeah, so one of the things that writers find difficult is getting inside their head. The moment of focus is where you need to be, because you have to hold so many things in your head at the same time, especially with fantasy books as well, because it's a whole new world. You've got to make sure all the physics works and these sorts of things. So you've got to be very focused. I have ear defenders, like they work on building sites. But sometimes I need music as well, and this is one of the pieces that inspires me to write, like an action scene.
Okay, so this is called The Calling by Zach Hemsey.
Being show here on Channel Radio. Who cares wins? Every Monday at noon on Channel Radio. I'm a rock
star. And welcome back to Who Cares Wins. That was a fantastic track. We've just been sharing composers and music tips in the studio with that piece of music. And so I'm definitely going to go away and look up Jack Hemsey after today. So my guest today has been Miles Allen, author, man of many talents, and we haven't had time to touch on most of his talents, but thank you so much for sharing your story with us today, Miles.
You're more than welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
Appreciate that it's quite an emotional journey that you've been on, and your honesty of sharing that with us. But just to say, as you say, writing can help. It's therapeutic in a way, but it also gives you that escapism to get inside your own head and invent something.
Yeah.
And so one thing we'd like to encourage people to do is, if you think you've got a book in you, even if you only got an idea in you, then speak to somebody about it. It might be Miles. It might be one of his new authors groups, but possibly even his course. So tell us one more time about your training course.
Yeah, well, if you've got a, you know, so many people have ideas sitting in their head, or it's on a shelf in a drawer, and you've written it handwritten or typed it up or something, and it may be for months or years. You should try and do something about it. What have you got to lose, really? But if you're interested in becoming a writer or just like to try something new, because people like to try different ideas, there's a number of questions that will come out probably from a writing viewpoint that stops people coming forward. One is, am I good enough? How would I ever get published? How on earth do you do something like a full-length novel? Where do I get the time to do that? And where do I even start? So those are the things that I'd answer if you come along on the course and make it all clear for you. So take you out of the dark. And at the end of it, you'll either be motivated to do it and you'll go, yes, I'll have a go at this, or you'll go, yeah, that's not for me. So I'll give you a very honest approach to what it really is like to be an author, and some really great things about it as well, which has changed my life. So I'd like to just share that with people and hope to get more people on there. And plenty of people I've done so far have done that.
So if you're interested in attending that workshop, coming to one of Miles's groups that happen, or just chatting with Miles about anything in particular, or even buying one of his books, that's what we're really encouraging you to do today. Well worth a read. The website is www.milesallen, that's MILESALLEN.net, and if you then do a / who cares wins, all the information about that workshop will be there in the fullness of time, but we'll also share that on Twitter and Facebook and all of our social media. Thank you again so much for joining me today, Miles.
Thank you
so much.
It's
been an absolute pleasure. So just before we run out of time, and we'll play out today with another one of Miles's tracks of Mr. Blue Sky by ELO to try and chase away these winter blues that are kicking in with the weather. But just before we do, a couple of events to let you know about. This coming Sunday the 6th of December, 12 to 4 p.m., there's a Christmas Mind, Body, Spirit Fair and Cafe in Sandwich. It's being held at the Stoner Cafe, that's a Sandwich industrial estate. And the lady who got in touch is Judy Down, and Judy is a hypnotherapist, a mindfulness instructor and PLT instructor. She tells us that on the day there'll be therapists, the Cherub Man, jewellery stalls, vintage handmade crafts, readings and aura photography, to name but a few. Lots available there. It's £2 on the door, no need to book in advance, just turn up on the door. Any questions, contact Judy on Judy Down, that's JUDIDOWN @gmail.com. And again, as always, we'll post that information onto the Facebook page. We had last week with Angela, the guest was Shirley Palmer, and Shirley kindly offered 3 signed copies of her books as competition. And all you need to do for that is to tweet at CaresWins, that's us at CaresWins, with the hashtag 12 words, that's 12 words, and tell us in the remaining characters what happiness, purpose or love mean to you. And both Angela and Shirley will get together over the airwaves, over whatever media they can do, to pick a winner from the entries. Actually, it's 3 winners from the entries to get those signed books. Doesn't matter where in the world you are, post and packaging will be covered and the book will get to you. So please do take the time to have a think about that, enter that competition, and when Angela returns, she'll announce the winners. Next week, if technology allows, I'm hoping that we can air the recordings from the Wellbeing Symposium, which took place on the 11th of November. Lots of fascinating interviews happened there, and if we get permission, we may also be able to play snippets of the actual talks. We're waiting on the rubber stamp on that one. So if all goes to plan, that will be next Monday, the 7th of December. And as a taster, you may have heard this a couple of weeks ago when I played it. I got to interview one of my sporting heroes, Tanny Gray Thompson, and we were chatting away, and one of the questions I posed to her elicited this reaction.
Do you know, I think that is the hardest question that I've ever been asked.
So there you go. I temporarily rendered her speechless, and I managed to ask her the hardest question she's ever been asked. And she's been interviewed a lot, I have to say. So if you want to know what that question was and her answer to it, you'll tune in next Monday on December the 7th, and when hopefully we'll have the Wellbeing Symposium show. But Thank you again. I can't stress this enough. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Miles.
You're welcome.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. And we're going to play out with some cheerful music. Bring on the blue sky of Brilliant. Summer. It's not here yet, but hold on to it, folks. Winter will soon be a distant memory. We're going to play you out today with ELO with Mr. Blue Sky. Have a wonderful week, everybody. Take care and see you soon. Bye for now.
Tell us why.